All right. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a Friday edition. Tom Gimbel from the LaSalle Network will be a little along a little bit later. We're going to talk about resumes and updating them and the idea that, you know, it's not just the piece of paper anymore. It's the social media sites and all of that. Andrea Haynes is here and she's laughing about, what are you laughing about?
I'm waving at one of your junior fans outside.
Oh, she's sweet. I thought you were laughing at me.
No,
that's better.
No.
But one of the other things that Gimbel is going to talk about is, you know, on the resume when it says, what is the, is it objective? Aspire to. And he says, get rid of it. No one reads it. And I've always hated that. It just seems so forced. And what I aspire to, a job at your place. That's what it really should say.
There you go. Yes. It does seem to exclude maybe things that you wouldn't want to exclude, right?
Yeah. And just the language of it's always. But anyway, so we'll talk to Tom about that. Mandy Antonacci will be along a little bit later as well to talk about the business of baseball. And I will help you deal with your $353 million Powerball winning, too. But right now, Andrea is here. And, well, Donald Trump spoke today at CPAC and talked again about the how he was going to bring in a better healthcare system. They're going to repeal Obamacare and bring it in with something better and less expensive. Hopefully they'll be able to do that. We'll see. But there's a story in Blue Sky about all of the jobs that sort of, well, two things, the different apps and businesses that were sort of that jumped up because of Obamacare. But I want to start with the businesses that could do more because of Obamacare. And, it, you know, it's like we're in the, well, this is going to be the day of Uber, but Uber's a good example of how Obamacare helped them attract workers.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's the whole gig economy that we talk about all the time, right? People that aren't necessarily tied to a particular job or a particular employer. They're able to do, you know, do piecework, do freelancing, and do jobs that a lot of the startups like Uber and many others rely on. And the reason they're able to do that is because they can get health insurance another way, so, other than having a full-time employer.
So Uber can draw these people and to work just a few hours a day.
Exactly.
Those people don't need to find a full-time job where they would get health care insurance.
Yep, and some of those startups are really relying on that workforce that was kind of freed up by having healthcare, you know, a little bit disconnected from your employer.
So the next question would be what happens, but I guess that's a question for no one knows.
To be determined, I guess, by whether it's in fact replaced, repealed, or what.
So if we do lose that independent workplace sort of marketplace idea, then these companies would either have to offer insurance or they just get workers who didn't need their insurance. They're not going to offer insurance.
It just does seem like the genie's out of the bottle a little bit, doesn't it? I mean, people are so, this has just become such a powerful force of people. You know, I think people will demand some kind of healthcare option outside of an employer. It's just hard for me to imagine things reversing completely to being reliant on an employer for health insurance.
Okay, so there's that. And then on the other side of it are all of these startups that sort of got a boost because of Obamacare, right? Are these mostly apps or software that would compare healthcare plans, or what kind of businesses are we talking about?
Yeah, this is the other aspect of Obamacare and its impact on startups. It just created a field of startups. There are those that help you comparison shop for plans, where they created online platforms where you can figure out which one you should buy. There were, you know, there are things that physicians have to do where startups cropped up to create software to help them. There's the whole rise of telemedicine, where you can, to some extent, contact your doctor and even get a diagnosis by using, you know, using technology to visit them rather than visiting them in person.
I love that. That's big in rural areas and things, right?
It is. It is. And even around here, we've talked about a few that have started up for things like dermatology, where you can send in a picture of what's wrong and have the doctor give you some idea of what's happening. So it encouraged that. So there were just a lot of kind of far-reaching impacts of Obamacare.
Of course, if Obamacare is dead, it doesn't mean these things are dead, right? They could adapt, or there might be a whole new crop of things to come up to deal with Trump care or Ryan care.
Absolutely. A lot of those things stick around. I think it's just the question of uncertainty right now that some of those companies are feeling.
All right. So it's been 90 seconds where we haven't been talking about Uber. Let's get back to it.
Get back to it.
You know, they're in trouble now. A woman who works there wrote a memo about enduring, suffering through sexual harassment. She'd complained about it, she said, and the person, the perpetrator was not punished. Rather, she was eventually. That's caused a huge firestorm. They brought in Eric Holder to run an investigation, the former attorney general. So I want to have this conversation on two planes. One is the specifics of it and what's going on. But the other is, and I think sometimes we have these forerunning companies, and Uber certainly is it, where it's a lightning rod for everything. And everything with it becomes amplified because it's the one that's leading and that's out there. And it seems like this might be a little bit of that.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And you laid out what happened really well. This blog post written by this woman really went viral very quickly over the holiday weekend of President's Day last weekend. People were reading it and reacting to it very quickly. And it is one of those people are already teed up to be angry at Uber for a variety of reasons. They seem to always be kind of stepping in it a little bit. And this really set people off. And it touches on that whole, you know, issue of diversity in the tech workforce and how women are received there. It touched a lot of buttons. People reacted very quickly. And something a little different was Uber also reacted really quickly this time.
Sort of. I mean, yeah. I mean, they didn't react
not
to her.
Quickly while she was undergoing the situation. Right. No, but quickly this week when, you know, sort of the firestorm began.
Right.
And yeah, I'm not necessarily giving them points for that, but I think they are.
But they did.
You know, I mean, they did jump in.
And they went high profile, too.
They did.
So there's that. And then I didn't realize, I know that the CEO had sat in on the president's council, right? He ended up resigning from it. But a lot of people quit Uber because of that. I didn't know until I read the story in Blue Sky that Uber continued to serve JFK when there was a taxi strike there over the immigration policy. I missed that whole thing.
Yeah. Is there anyone they haven't angered at this point? And people are primed to protest right now, right? I think people are just primed to say, like, we are fighting it. So everything, as you mentioned, is really being amplified.
And so with Uber in trouble that way, they came up, I'm trying to remember, there was a connection here as well, but one of the other stories in Blue Sky this week was about when to hire an HR department or when to create HR. And it's a good question because a lot of these startups, they're fly by night or they're, you know, they need to be lean. So I would imagine an HR and a book of conduct and all of that is way down on their list. I know why. It's because of Uber and the way they handled this, that these young companies, these small companies need to, at the very beginning, come up with HR policies.
Yeah, we looked at a couple different aspects kind of stemming out of the original news about Uber. And one was this idea of just startups in general. Obviously, Uber at this point is huge. They're not, you know, they're not a tiny startup anymore. But it underlines that issue of these companies start with this idea that we are going to break the rules. That's what we're here for, right? We're going to break the rules. We're not going to worry about these old fuddy-duddy things that companies worry about.
We're not going to be that Uber with all that huge HR department. We're going to run our own way.
Exactly. So we took a look at, if you are a startup, though, really, when do you need to consider starting to get some of those policies in place so that you're prepared, you know, as your staff grows and as issues come up?
And the answer was day two?
The answer pretty much was day one. In
day
fact,
one? Yeah.
People were tweeting today. They're like, pretty much day one, you have to have some plans in place.
Which would, I would imagine, provide for another opportunity for startup businesses, right, to provide HR or to do that sorts of software.
Yeah, for sure. And there's all kinds of companies that are trying to improve HR and that, how we use it.
We had Adam Ochstein from StratX in was just last Friday, and that's what they do.
Yep.
I would imagine if you have your vision on this great growing business and success, you're focused on getting your product to market, not so much on protecting yourself against HR lawsuits. So
absolutely.
It's got to be hard to spend the money there.
That's understandable. And I think just the behavior of the founding team too, though, and how you behave and how you're encouraging others to behave can go a long way too. I mean, you're setting the message from the top, right?
Andrea Haynes is the editor for Blue Sky Innovation and also Red Eye, which was just out yesterday.
Yes, new Red Eye's out yesterday, and it's a big week for Mardi Gras celebrations and for the Oscars, among other things.
And so we were just talking off the air. You've seen all of the Best Picture nominees?
I am the worst at seeing movies in theaters, so I have a little cramming to do this weekend before Sunday night.
Well, luckily the winter's returned, so you have nothing to do but go to the movie theater.
Exactly.
It's 12:23. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Tom Gimbel is in the studio, the CEO, the man behind the LaSalle Network, and he comes by to talk about workplace issues from time to time.
Yep.
Tom, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Steve.
Missed you last Friday.
I was traveling. I had to pay the bills. I was in California making some.
We don't pay you enough to come. Oh, wait, we don't pay you anything to come out here.
It's friendship.
I like this, and I value that. I like the topic today, the idea of looking at your resume. And it's springtime. It felt like summer last week.
Yep.
Why not do a little spring cleaning for the resume? And so there are a few things about that is because I think people sort of stress and dwell on the resume and getting it done and getting it done perfectly. And then once they do, they just want it. They put it to bed. Like,
yep.
I got that behind me. But you're kind of arguing that it's really never behind you.
No, it's your career. You know, it is the play-by-play of your career. And, you know, I don't think that if you're really happy in your job and things are going great, you should be working on your resume every
month. Right.
However, if you're in that inflection point that you're thinking, maybe I'll want to in the spring or the summer, and it's in your head that you're not getting the promotion you want, or is there a different angle or avenue you want to take your career, start working on it. Don't wait until somebody calls you about a job.
And the other thing to remember is it's not just the piece of paper or the file that you're sending, it's your social media sites.
Absolutely. You're coordinating. You are now the campaign manager, if you will, of your career. And that involves your LinkedIn. It involves your resume, both electronic and print, because things get formatted differently. And some people print them out. Some people send it. Mac versus Word. I mean, there's a lot of testing you should be doing on this, too.
Tell me that again. What do you mean?
So if you work on a Windows environment, send it to a Mac computer, see how it formats and views on that. Right. And then if you're sending it in on a cover letter, say, I did this on a Word doc. It may not. I tested it on a Mac. I just want to let you know it formats differently.
Right. Okay.
Right. People only see what they see. If they open it on your phone, it looks differently. And every little bit is important of whether people delete it or whether they forward it on to somebody else.
You know, I mean, I get probably 300 to 400 emails a day.
Yep.
You know that. I've missed emails because
I don't take it personally.
I'm very quick with the delete. I don't have time for it. I'm deleting 20 at a time. And so you've got to catch someone early, and you can't afford to lose them that
No,
way.
And you can't be afraid. There's a difference between being persistent and being a pain in the neck, too, right? So you're exactly right. People will delete things on accident, and if they don't know somebody, they don't go back, or I'll do it later. So you do it again in a week or 3 days. You don't want to send it 7 times.
No.
But 2 or 3 times to make sure it's top of mind, it makes a difference.
Yeah, please do that for me, because I probably did delete it accidentally. Another thing, which is a great topic, you have to update what softwares you're proficient in. The idea is that, like, you wouldn't want to put Excel now because it's kind of accepted. If you put that, it shows you as you're dated.
Yeah, it shows you're dated, but at the same time, if you're proficient, you want to put, you know, expert level financial modeling on Excel, right? What you're really good at. The worst thing you can do is put that you used a software, Salesforce or SAP or Oracle, and then you go in for an interview and they go, well, tell me about that. Well, I didn't really use it. And it's like, you know what? You've just ruined your credibility. You used it as a hook and you can't back it up. Doesn't work.
And really, my least favorite part of any resume is the objective section. Well, because what it should say is, I want you to hire me.
Exactly right. Exactly right. My objective is to get a job for your organization. And what really happens is people will go and customize their objective. I want to work for Steve Bertrand at WGN Radio. And then you go and you interview at, obviously, a lesser station, and you didn't change your objective. And they go, you know what? You're done.
Also, objective in working with others or my kids or whatever, that more than any area becomes the most stilted, unreadable language.
Yes.
You know, achieve, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it ends up that it's something that means nothing.
It takes creative writing to a whole new world. I mean, I interviewed a young person who graduated from college, right? And I said, skilled negotiator. I said, maybe they should send you with Rex Tillerson over to the Middle East. What is skilled negotiator at 22?
Exactly.
Right? I know people who are, and maybe they're very good at it, right? But you know what I'm saying.
And so there's going to be no winning there. Just get rid of it. Don't
Absolutely.
Include it. And then one other thing that we were talking about earlier, a little bit about how you have to catch someone, it's all in the top third. It really is.
People start, you want to start with what you're doing right now. Now, if you've been a job hopper, you have a new job every year, that takes it away a little bit. But hopefully you're coming out of a 4 to 6 year job where you've got that stability and it shows. And make sure you look at what verb tense you're using. Are you doing it or did you do it? You know, is it action items? I created, I built versus I managed and I coordinated.
Right.
Those are
action,
very
action.
Different words. Absolutely.
Tom Gimbel, the CEO of the LaSalle Network. You can follow on Twitter at LaSalle Network.
And at Tom Gimbel, and our website is LaSalleNetwork.com.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
Hey, March Madness is just around. We've got 2 more weeks.
Maybe you'll come over for the party this year.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a shot. It's the business. I don't go out. Everyone knows that. Thank you, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, say you won a $453 million Powerball drawing. What would you do with the money? Well, we will talk a little bit later in the program with Kathy Roser. She's a managing director and wealth advisor at Morgan Stanley. And you don't have to win $453 million to actually follow some of her advice. So we'll do that. But first, we'll follow the advice of Mandy Antonacci. She writes for Inc.com and elsewhere, joins us from time to time to talk about sports and business. And she's on a phone line now. Mandy, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome back to the U.S. of A. You were in Monaco recently?
I was. I was in Monaco for the Laureus Sports Awards, which is a global sports awards event. So think of it as almost like the Oscars for sports.
Did you run into anyone we know?
I ran into a lot of people we know. One in particular, which I think you and the city of Chicago will be proud of, was the Cubs owner Tom Ricketts, and he accepted an award on behalf of the Cubs, and their award was the World Team of the Year Award, and it was a great honor for him to accept.
It's a nice thing, and we're not only – well, I guess maybe that does make us the world champions.
I think it does. I think that cements it, if anything, right?
Cubs tickets went on sale today, in fact, for single games. It's significant, though, because baseball is not really such a world event, where a lot of soccer and all of that does have a world following. What is it that got the Cubs to that award?
Do you know, it was really, I think, just overcoming the curse and the deficit. And I can tell you, just looking at some of the players in the room that were from soccer, like you said, and other European-dominated sports, I mean, there was really not a dry eye in the house when they were playing the film and the footage that was leading the Cubs to a Game 7. It was really an emotive, I think, experience for all of the countries represented in the room to see. I actually had a comment after where I leaned over to the person next to me, and I had chills from head to toe, and I said, I know how the story ends, right?
That's nice, and well, I'm glad you were there to tell that, because I hadn't read anything about that before. Baseball is in the news here as well, spring training, obviously. But, you know, the Major League Baseball is always obsessed, I think, with speeding things up or making things more attractive in this way or another. I don't know if they always hit the mark, and the newest thing is this idea of getting rid of the intentional walk, or at least eliminating the pitches, with the idea that it's, I guess, going to save time, make the game shorter.
It's true. You know, we're not at the stage where we could talk about drone reporters and robotic umpires,
right?
But there are some incremental improvements that are being made. So one of the things that we will see this year is automation of the intentional walk. So instead of that four-pitch walk, it's going to move to a dugout signal. Now, truthfully, when you think about this as a means of saving time, we're only going to save about 1 minute of dead time per walk.
And there may be, or what? There might be... Probably most games are only one or two intentional walks, if any.
Oh, there's very few. I want to say that I think the number of intentional walks is one every 2.5 games.
Wow.
So it's pretty infrequent. But I think what that will actually do is, aside from speed up the actual time, it will speed up the pace of the game, which is also really important to Commissioner Rob Manfred.
Because of just to keep people's attention?
Well, really, Major League Baseball is having an issue where they are lacking engagement of a younger demographic of fans. And we have this very fast-paced, rapid, technology-induced generation that's checking out of baseball. And he's very hypersensitive to that and has enacted a number of measures, some that are still being debated with MLB Players Association. But there are some that we're going to see that will affect the 2017 season.
What other things is he trying to do? What are you talking about?
So he's also talking about a two-minute limit on replay, which is something that we will see. But he also wants to institute a pitch clock and raise the strike zone above the knee and also cut down on mound visits. And I actually had an opportunity to chat with third baseman of the Chicago Cubs, Chris Bryant, about that strike zone change. And, of course, I wanted his opinion on the matter. He quickly reminded me of how tall he is. So I think he's about 6'5". So for him, he was in favor of it. For sure.
He liked the idea.
He loved the idea. He said, you know, as a tall guy, I'm all for raising that strike zone because that will help me. And when I specifically asked him what he feels players can do to really start to engage this younger demographic, you know, he turned quickly to social media. And he said, I think we need to continue to be role models for this younger generation and use our social channels to exude that to try to draw in a younger demographic of fans.
You know, and you and I have talked about that, about different players. I know Anthony Rizzo is really good at it when it comes to building it, and the idea, the conflict of where sometimes that's an individual brand versus a team brand. But I guess the bottom line of it all is it would be a plus for baseball, and so it's a good thing to continue on and try to build on.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting, when we last spoke about this a few months ago, we were focused on the players doing their job in social media. Now here we are, fast forward just a few short months, Major League Baseball's making changes, and companies themselves are making changes to their traditional business models as well.
I want to talk about that and what they're doing at Topps to speed things up. But I wonder if, and I know the answer is no, but I wonder if there's a counter-marketing value to the serenity of the pace of baseball, because everything else is so fast-paced, boom, 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 that maybe you could, people would be attracted to baseball for just the opposite reason, that it is slow and a little bit more relaxed. You know what, I as I say it out loud, I know that wouldn't work because I'd be on my phone checking Twitter and all of that too. It would be nice maybe if it would.
Well, you know, you voiced a really interesting perspective that a lot of retired professional baseball players are actually voicing in the media, too. And there's a lot of people who are against these changes and want to preserve the game's integrity.
Yeah, I think retired might be the key word there.
There you go.
So tell me about Topps. What are they trying to do to keep people's attention?
So I think this is a really cool example of a company that's based on a traditional model. Topps is a baseball trading cards company who, in fact, changed their business model and product offering to attract that younger demographic. So they started to experiment with a new product line. They're calling it Topps Now. And what that does is that when big and memorable events happen, new cards are made on demand and released the following day, sold exclusively on Topps' website with a window of just 24 hours. So to give you an example, Bartolo Colon's first career home run at the age of 42 last year against San Diego, they captured that moment in a trading card, sold it on their website the very next day for just 24 hours, and it actually outsold every other one that was made that season.
So how many cards are we talking about?
I think they sold close to 9,000 cards at $9.99 each in a 24-hour window.
So that's the sort of thing where people have to act. They're engaged that way. They know it picks up the pace a little bit. Are the other sports better than baseball when it comes to being a little more fast-paced and socially engaging?
For sure. I mean, I think the best example that I often give is that there's no touchdown dance that's happening on home plate, right? So, and every time something happens, whether it's a pitcher that gets a little too excited, maybe too hard or heavy of a fist bump or whatever it might be, we hear about some of these crazy fines and warnings that the players are getting. And I think it's, you know, really a testament to the energy, the passion and excitement that baseball could truly have, but perhaps they're being handicapped by the traditional of the sport.
All right, Mandy Antonacci, listen, come to Chicago one day this summer. We'll go to the ballpark. We'll just sit around and we'll do nothing like a couple of retirees for 3 hours.
I would actually love it. That sounds like a dream for me. So look forward to it, Steve. Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll talk again soon. That's Mandy Antonacci. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Jim, as well. It's just about 12:52 here on the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, someone in Lafayette, Indiana, won that big Powerball drawing, $453.3 million. Of course, it's less than that if you take it in a lump sum, take out the taxes, but still probably enough to live on. Kathy Roser is on a phone line now. She's the Managing Director of Wealth and Wealth Advisor at Morgan Stanley here in Chicago. Kathy, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Great to be here.
So it wasn't you, right? You didn't win the Powerball. You wouldn't have taken my phone call.
Exactly.
But I would imagine, so the things we're going to talk about, obviously, to that one person in Lafayette who's listening to us and is going to share her winnings, would be others who maybe inherit a big chunk of money or get a settlement in one way or another. It's all great. It's gravy in many ways, but you've got to have a little bit of a strategy about how to deal with it and how to kind of accept it into your life.
Right, exactly. You know, handling wealth can be a difficult task for those who are lucky enough to receive that large financial windfall. And I talk about going dark and lawyering up if I was that Powerball winner.
Really?
Or I came into a lot of that money. You know, it's important that once you get over that emotion and that exhilaration of this is that you have an even temperament. And get through that thought that you'd be impulsive and say maybe I'd quit my job or I'd move to Europe. You really need to take a step aside and decompress and then really assess your options.
I don't know, man. I get that. If I see that winning ticket, I know that there are people. In fact, this is a good case where we're still waiting to see exactly who the person is who won this money. If I'm holding a ticket like that, I am running to the lottery office so that I can show them and not risk losing it. That's what that's what scares me the most.
Yeah, and I think the first step is that you really take that first 6 months after you come into some type of money like this and put it in the safest place possible, such as a 3 to 6 month CD. And then you really need to put together a professional team. And that's what I meant by lawyering up. You need to assemble that team because this isn't a task that can really be undertaken alone. And, you know, you'd want to have a world-class financial advisor to review your assets and put together that financial plan and figure out that investment strategy. And then, of course, you're going to need a tax advisor. Most Americans are used to paying anywhere from 15 to 30% in taxes. But when you have that kind of money, you're at the 39.6% tax rate.
You say that you need a tax advisor and an accountant. I'm still trying to save money. I can't just hire one of them?
Yeah. Well, you know, it depends on the sophistication. I think if you come into that kind of money, there's a lot of planning that you need to do in order to be tax efficient with what you're doing. So an accountant and tax advisor, those two people can work together on that. And then, of course, you're going to need an attorney, and it gets a little bit more sophisticated in there with having an estate plan and a business plan about what you're going to do with the money going forward.
So you say go dark right away, but can I squeeze in maybe a trip to Europe or a trip to Disney World or something to celebrate?
Yes, once you make sure you have done something with that lotto ticket, and as long as you've got the money, you know, in a secure place, that's the first step.
All right, and then another thing, and this is something that I hear about. Well, you hear about it with pro athletes that when someone comes into money, that other family members or friends come out of the woodwork and are asking for help. And I would imagine most of us, if we come into a lot of money, would want to help our loved ones, but you have to do it in sort of a strategic way.
Yeah, you really need to learn how to say no. And so sometimes I think one of the best strategies I've seen is where you have a team of advisors that help you manage through the sheer amount of requests and put together a committee or some trusted friends that I call could be the grant committee that helps buffer you from family and friends and business people that'll come to you asking for money. And that's the story you see time and time again, where it's a pro athlete or somebody else who has a lot of money, they have a hard time saying no. And so if you have that team, it's treating it like a business.
And you're telling me that if I win $100 million or inherit $50 million, I don't know how that would happen, that I would still have to set up and live by a budget?
You have to live by a budget, because what ends up happening is you overspend and everybody gets stuck into this impulse purchasing. So to make sure this windfall doesn't evaporate quickly, and you see time and time again of the people who win the lotto, and in a short time they become irresponsible and then the money evaporates. So just having a budget helps you stay organized and stay on track. And most people aren't accustomed to having excess money, so this will just give you that discipline to preserve your winnings and not go on a wild spending spree.
All right.
I think you could do it with a little bit.
All right, Kathy Roser, if I win, I'll take you out to lunch and I'll let you pick. You can pick the most expensive spot you want.
I'll take you up on that.
Kathy Roser is Managing Director and Wealth Advisor at Morgan Stanley in Chicago. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.